Will they?
Who is that guy?
There's a good friend of mine I've known for a while. And
Alex comes to you.
And he likes him too. What about me? Jim Furr likes him too. He's my friend, bro. Josh Corder, who is a teacher, I think he'll tell you more, at Dharma Punks, for those of you who know Dharma Punks, and even the East Village, it's a great organization. Again, he'll tell you more about that. But it's from the Theravada tradition. And Josh is really steeped in that tradition, has a lot of really deep knowledge, and I've always been really impressed by how he can just bring his knowledge of the tradition into his everyday life, and particularly around this topic of intoxicants, whether it's drugs and alcohol or whatever it is we use to intoxicate ourselves. So, please give him your full attention, and I know you'll learn. Even if you think you know everything about Theravada, the tradition, you'll learn something more tonight. Just let me switch it on the mic, not give you the signal. Just,
sorry for my ass.
Hi, Phil. How you doing?
Yes, I am Josh. I am the teacher at Dharma Punks. I've been the teacher there for I think about 7 years now. And as Chodo Robert said, I am very, very steeped in the Thai forest tradition, specifically the Kamatthana tradition or lineage, which is roughly runs down from Ajahn Lee through Ajahn Jeff, who I've studied with for many years. I also have been lucky to study with a number of going through like a actually, I speak really loudly, so I doubt anybody will have a problem hearing me, but it's weird hearing my voice echo as if from the clouds. Yeah, so I've studied with a lot of other teachers. Before I came to the Theravada, I studied for a number of years in Tibetan, and also sat in some zendos, and I've studied with a lot of lay practitioners as well. Specifically, one of my teachers for a long time was a guy named Noah Levine, who was the guy that founded Dharma Punks. But Noah and I are a little bit different, in that Noah comes very much from the Vipassana school. Am I feeding back? Noah and I are a little bit different, in that I tend to, he always complains to me that I teach so traditionally inside of the school of the Thai forest tradition. So don't think that I am like the embodiment of Dharma Punks. I'm just a mic'd tattoo person. It's my chain.
Chain.
One by one, you strip me of all my
worldly possessions,
leaving
me
in my tradition. Actually, there are a lot of tattooed monks, so I'm still, if I want that path, I'm still okay. All right, intoxication. I am going to sort of, you'll note that from the tradition I practice in, I do tend to start from the suttas and the teachings in the Pali Canon, and then I tend to add in my own experience. So sometimes I'm going to be using Pali words, which is the language that the Pali Canon was written in, and it's some of the oldest teachings attributed to the Buddha. So with that, intoxication. Roughly speaking, intoxication falls into what's known as a chain of suffering that we create for ourselves, called the paticca samuppada, and it's the chain of dependent co-arising. It's how we create our own suffering. And part of the problem is that we don't, we blame our suffering and our stress on the world, on the people around us, on the situations. And that's what the Buddha called the first arrow. The insults, slights, difficulties that we encounter as being human beings. There are inevitable events that are disagreeable. And so that's what the Buddha referred to as the first arrow. And he said that all people, even those who are enlightened, experience the first arrow. We all grow old, we all become sick, we all experience death, we all are separated from those we love eventually, and the things we love we're separated from. These are the inevitables of human existence, the first arrow. The Buddha's teachings concern the second arrow, which he said was the arrow we shoot into ourselves. And actually, he should have said arrows, because in my experience, it's obsessional and repetitive how many times we shoot ourselves. And one of the great ways, in fact, that the Buddha said we shoot ourselves with the second arrow, I heard people sharing about, is that tendency to add, this experience belongs to me alone, this thought that I'm lesser than, or I'm alone, or this is happening to me, is that whole idea of I am alone, nobody can understand what I'm going through. That I-ness is what he says is at the root of something called papancha, which is his word for obsession, which then is at the root of so much of the suffering that we incur for ourselves. But let's go back to the paticca-samuppada. Roughly the idea is because we have stress that we carry around, it's might be historical stress, it could be physical stress, the attention in our bodies, it can be obsessional thinking, but we have internal stress. And the core delusion, avijja, means that we look out into the world and we try to find the solution externally or in the wrong place. We don't see that I'm holding my stress, I'm holding my suffering, and we look for the solution outside. Even the Buddha said ideas that come from outside, or identities that come from outside, or intoxicants, or addictions, spending, anything. We look for the solution outside of where the root problem is. So the chain goes roughly like this. There's stress, dukkha, and then we look for the solution. We make contact with something that we think will help us. That's fassa, P-H-A-S-S-A. Then we move on to this physical relaxation when we see, oh, that hat looks very nice. I think that would be the difference between my suffering and a truly happy, endlessly peaceful existence. That is what's known as vedana, a relaxation of the body. Vedana is the core gut stress that we carry around in the relaxation of it. Then, once we have that note that the body relaxation comes before the thinking, and that's actually very true. It's been shown time and time again by the works of neuroscientists that before there's thought, there is an underlying gut reaction to everything we experience. So then we move on to what you've heard of before as craving, tanha, and that really translates to the word appetite. We develop an appetite for the thing we see, the idea, the identity. Oh, if only I became a doctor, then my parents would love me. Oh, if only I became rich, then I'd have the esteem of my high school buddies. Oh, if only I had 1,000 Facebook friends, then I would be popular, etc. So that's tanha. And then when we actually get the thing we're searching for, that's upadana. Now, upadana is often translated as clinging or attachment. But actually, upadana literally means feeding. We're feeding off of something. We're consuming it. We're trying to eat it. We're eating it. And the problem is we continue to consume it well beyond its natural lifespan. And generally, we consume the things that give us short-term pleasure, but long-term stress. It's basically, look at the junk food analogy in life. We tend to love things that taste sugary or whatever, you know, have trans fat. So we go towards the things that taste or feel good in the short term, but in the long term are not good for us, as opposed to the ideas, the things. For example, we chase after sensual pleasures, material wealth, the four worldly winds of gain, sensual pleasures, esteem and praise from other people, and fame. And we chase after these external things that feel good but keep us hunting for them because they don't last very long. So we need to keep this samsara-esque constant search for these short-term pleasures. And that, the Buddha says, then eventually turns into the worst form, which is bhava, which is, literally it's when we become our obsessions. We've fed on them so much that we literally become it. For example, when I was a kid, and I was a very lonely 13-year-old, I first saw Led Zeppelin. Dating myself, but that's all right. That's okay. Probably with Bob's Cream or something like that. So, so I'm at least a slight, a half a generation later. anyway.
There's the compassion here.
And there's not. Equanimity first, using compassion where it is useful. I'll talk about that. So, so I somehow got to Led Zeppelin. Yeah, when I saw Led Zeppelin and I thought, wow, I'm of this, you know, I feel alone. I feel like nobody likes me. I feel like all of my 13-year-old awkwardness is mine alone. So if only I could become Jimmy Page and could play an instrument really well, that would be the solution to all my problems. So I became, I stole the money to get a guitar, a bass, I started learning how to play it. I played it or fed off of it, upadana, until it became my identity. I was going to be a rock musician. So, of course, the pleasures that are derived from this external solution to these internal problems are very short-lived. Sure, you might play a show and girls might say, oh, you were so good or whatever like that. But that acclaim is very short-lived. And then I would go back home again alone and be stuck again in that sense of loneliness and have to play more, have to become even better at the instrument, have to find even more praise. So part of becoming is needing more and more and more. It is the state of intoxication between upadana and bhava, between feeding off of and literally becoming something is that stage of intoxication. Now, the solutions that we bring to working with others and to ourselves, especially to working with others who are experiencing suffering, I've had to do a lot of recently, in my life I've had to do quite a number of work with people in hospitals, but of late I've had a couple of people who've been long-term hospitalized. And there's a bunch of factors that the Buddha talked about that are important to bring to that practice. And all of them are undermined by intoxication. And I'll tell you what they are and then how they're undermined and stuff like that. The factors are, of course, metta, which are loving kindness, greeting whatever you see first without this judgmental, you know, you're separate, different, I'm suspicious of you. The normal way that we greet everything that arises in our path is this sense of survival first, you know, until you prove that you are safe. I'm going to keep you at a distance. And of course, part of the practice is to drop that and to try to at least wish and extend the warm thoughts that we hope that everyone will be released from the suffering that they cause from themselves. And that's a very different approach to most people. So that's metta. The second is karuna, which is compassion. And that's when we empathize, not empathizing from the distance of pity, like, oh, you poor, sick, suffering person, I'm well right now. I couldn't possibly ever wind up in the situation that you're in. It's actually a understanding knowledge that all suffering is universal. There's nothing individual about it. So when we greet someone, we greet them from the point of view of empathy based on mutual experience, finding that understanding deep within that I'm connected to this person by the very human nature that this will happen to me in some form or another. Maybe the particulars will be different, but I will experience aging, sickness, I will experience loss. And those are the important universals that we all are going to experience. So that's karuna. Kanti, which for me is the most important to work on, I'll talk about that a little later, that's patience. And patience is the ability to sit comfortably with oneself while somebody, you know, if you've ever, obviously if you've been to, and you know this well, you've been to hospitals where people are very gravely sick, most of the time they're not communicating. The whole TV version of things is that there's this deathbed conversation or, you know, there's a lot of talking going on. In my experience, no, not really. Most of the time, I'm just sitting there. There's no conversation. I'm just being present. And that's really, excuse my language, fucking hard. Because sitting with someone and being present, not only to what's going on with them, but what's going on inside of me, that balance is so hard to keep because there's always this tendency to want to become over-involved in me, over-involved in them, and lose track of how to keep myself patient and calm. Equanimity is the practice of using our compassion wisely. As I was joking with Chodo earlier, the Buddha said there are some beings we will not be able to help. Sorry to bring the news to you. Probably know that already. There are people we just will not be able to help. Even though we want to, they will be resistant. They might, you know, you might come in. They might not like the way you look. They might not like the way you're dressed. There might be something in the past that you remind them of. You have no control over it. And it's just, so, also there's just people who are just too far gone or we don't have the tools to help. I use the analogy of the heart surgeon. You would want a heart surgeon to be attentive to each patient, but if they couldn't help a specific patient, you wouldn't want them to dote and spend all the time with that patient when they could be meeting with and working with patients that they could help. So equanimity is using our compassion wisely. Of course, there's this idea that we want to solve every being's suffering, but I'm sorry to say, you're not going to be able to do that, nor am I. Wish I had those powers, don't have them, too bad. Okay, the last is yoniso manasikara. Don't ask me how to spell it, because I always spell it wrong. But it is what's known as attention. And it's basically, along with metta and along with Kanti, it's that ability to be with somebody and not force them to see, you know, tell them how they're causing their own suffering, but to be there as they themselves witness their own chain of suffering. Help them see how they're causing their own obsessions, their own worry, how their attachments, their feeding off of ideas or whatever are causing themselves suffering. So yoniso manasikara, the Buddha said, is a practice of first observing and then seeing what the advantages are of the things that we're clinging to. For instance, bhavasava, which is clinging to the idea of if I only had more life to live, I would somehow be happy in that future. Virtually everybody has bhavasava, that idea that I can't be really truly happy now. So I need a lot more life. Because then, in that future, that's where I'll get that happiness. And that is a form of suffering. So there's a whole bunch, Kamasava, Dityasava, I'm not going to go into it, all of those. But we see what people get from it. For instance, if I cling to use of drugs, in the short term they bring me release of stress. But in the long term they make me dependent, they make me isolated, they make me increasingly devoted to accumulating the drug itself rather than being in the world with other people, etc. So we see what the advantages and the disadvantages are, and then we find alternatives. There are always healthy alternatives to whatever our attachments are. The problem is that most of them are not fun in the short term. For instance, meditation, not fun in the short term. I've met maybe one person or two people who've sat down and in their first, you know, year of meditation have found it completely easy. And part of me has wanted to kill each of them. No, I don't. That would be breaking the precepts, but which I would never do. With meditation, it takes a long time. Like exercise. You exercise. Only a fool would go to the gym, exercise once, and then expect to see muscles and body toning. It takes a long time. The payoff is delayed. That's what the Buddha called kama and vipaka, which is cause and effect. And the problem with intoxicants is that we see only the short-term effects, and we don't see the long-term effects of our actions. We become addicted to things that have short-term payoffs. We don't see the long term. Interesting, the Buddha said the one question you should ask a monk or an enlightened person, if you ever meet an arahant, is what action should I do to make me happy in the long term and those in my life happy in the long term? Not the short term, but in the long term. So intoxicants fall into a few categories. I'm going to tell you what they are. They are of physical rupa, which is things like drugs, alcohol, etc. And then there's citta mata, which is intoxicants of ideas, mind. Stuff like the Buddha said there are four basic ideas that we become intoxicated to. We become intoxicated to ideas of how we'll get sensual pleasures. There are our ideas and opinions of the world, and those cause us a lot of stress and suffering. Have you ever sat at a wedding in a table of eight, seven of them are Republicans? Six, actually, my wife is not a Republican, so I have. Believe me, if you cling to those views and opinions, the suffering will mount. Like, there is there's identity views. Who am I? Clinging to the idea of what I'm capable of, what I'm good at, what I'm bad at, what my story is. Those, if we cling to them, will cause stress and suffering. If I have this idea that, for instance, I'm a smart guy, and that my smartness, my intelligence, will be able to be the thing that will help you, then what happens one day, like today, when I wake up and I'm not particularly brilliant, haven't had the coffee hit yet, the old acetylcholine isn't firing in the frontal lobe. Not much is happening up here right now, so I'm not the smart guy that I like to think. If I'm limited to that view of who I am, then I can't use other things, other approaches to try to reach and be of use. So I have to be willing to drop those stories of who I am, what I'm good at. And I have to be willing to drop the habits also, my rituals, my routines. So those are the four. The Buddha said that the core of samadhi, right view of ourselves and the world, is to not cling to any of them. That's the core. There are right views and there are wrong views. Right view, for example, would be generosity, compassion, equanimity, appreciation of the good things that we've done, our virtue, appreciation of the virtue of other people. But if we cling to any of those practices when they're not working, that's not equanimity. That's not being smart. So we have to be willing to drop everything. The Buddha used the analogy of the raft crossing the shore. We make the raft out of things we find. We cross the river to the other shore, and then we're willing to drop the tools that we don't need, because we don't need them anymore. So it's very important to have spiritual tools to work with, but it's equally important not to cling to them when they're not working, to have a lot of spiritual tools so that when one's not working, you can go to another. I use the idea of a handyman. If a handyman came to your house, or let's say a carpenter or somebody who's going to help you build a cabinet, and the only thing he had was a hammer in his toolbox, that was it, you'd be a little bit suspicious. You'd say, well, I hate the fact that I use this analogy because I don't know anything about carpentry, but you'd say, well, where are your other tools? Where's your saw? Where's your other stuff that you carpenters use? That's really all I know, hammer and saw. Isn't that sad? All right. Anyway, you get the idea. You want to have a lot of tools. You don't want to be over-reliant on any one tool. So what are the, how does the tools that we need to work with people who are suffering, how are they undermined by intoxication? Well, I just made a list, which will help me because there's so many. I'm going to just give you a bunch of them. When we are addicted, it obscures where the true suffering is. A lot of times when we're addicted to any substance or even addicted to ideas, we don't see how much physical stress is a component to our suffering. We think it's all external. Very much so, a core root of addiction and intoxication is the idea that all of the suffering that I feel is caused by what's outside of me. And so it feeds into this delusion. And one of the things that intoxicants do is they dull awareness of the body, awareness of the gut sensations, awareness of the true components of our suffering. Another thing they do is they put suffering off often. For instance, if I have a tough day, I don't realize that the cause of the tough day was my expectations or the fact that I didn't have enough body awareness or whatever. And then I'm feeling stressed and I drink, for example, or I go out and I shop, or I call up somebody and immediately get lost in their dramas. Whatever intoxicates me, I'm putting off the relationship between the cause and the effect. And by doing that, I don't see what the relationship between cause and effect is. I don't see, by putting it off and delaying suffering, I'm obscuring seeing the truth of how I'm causing my own suffering. And it's very important to understand this because in order to work with anybody else, I have to know myself. If I don't know how I'm causing my unnecessary suffering in life, I can't help you. I just can't. I've had to see everything, how I cause my suffering clearly through loads, years of depression and working through that. If I don't see it, I'm useless to you. So it's really important for me not to obscure the relationship between how I'm causing my suffering and the suffering itself. Next is, it makes us more reactive. Any form of intoxication reduces our ability to choose and keeps us caught in very reactive fight or flight type things, especially when I've worked with people who are in desperate situations. There's often a lot of aggression or defensiveness or standoffness or just suspicion. And if I'm in any way engaged in intoxication, real craving in my life, it makes me so much more reactive, defensive. I'm so much more likely not to be calm and greet them with patience. I'm so much more trapped in that cycle of defending myself. All forms of intoxicants like alcohol, painkillers, they shut down the frontal lobe, which makes compassion almost impossible because that's where compassion is rooted. Now let's talk about some of the ideas like self, identity views, and views and opinions. Self, addiction with my idea of who I am, how important I am, don't you know that I'm somebody that's done a lot of work in this area. Any form of this kind of intoxication with Josh Korda makes me so much more defensive when I'm dealing with people. If I greet somebody, I've had a lot of people that I greet that immediately go for the making fun of Buddhism, making fun of, you know, oh, you're into some Eastern philosophy. And if I let that get to me every time I try to be of use to somebody, I would so much more be diminished in my affectivity. So much of working with people is getting through these defensive walls. And I cannot be reactive. And in order to not be reactive, I cannot be caught up in the story of, don't you know who I am? I've been teaching for this long. I've got, you know, blah, blah, blah on the internet. I've been interviewed by these, you know, newspapers and stuff. If I get caught up in any of that bullshit, then I'm no longer going to be able to hear you, and I'm going to want you to be respectful and all this bullshit that doesn't help anybody. Caught up in self makes me take things personally that are universal, which we were talking about earlier, that eyeing, that putting in front of my experience, putting the sense, I own this. And I become less able to meet you from a place of understanding and sharing how everything that happens in life basically is universal. Everybody gets dumped. Everybody gets fired. Everybody gets rejected. Everybody feels loneliness. Everybody feels suspicion. Everybody feels hopeless and powerless. Everybody feels the important emotions and moods of life. But if I start adding that addiction with me in front of my experience, immediately I own my experience, and I don't believe that you really get it. I don't believe that you really understand. Then there's habits and opinions that makes me trapped in certain ways to respond. Of course, I've found myself working with people who are trapped in horrendous addictions to heroin and other substances. I work with a lot of heroin addicts, and I found that there's these specific tools and approaches that I love to go to, and sometimes they just don't work. And I really have to be willing to drop my infatuation with these specific little tools that I love to use. Because sometimes with some people they just don't work, and I have to be creative. I have to open up to the idea that that this solution that I've used before might not work with person B. So I have to drop that infatuation. All forms of intoxication create what the Buddha called kriya, which is mental agitation, because we think about the things that we're intoxicated with. And the more we fill up the mind, the more we are less able to take in and allow space for what's going on with other people. I know I've heard Bob talk about the empty vessel. It's really not a metaphor that's used in the Theravada, but it's a wonderful metaphor. And the idea of being able to empty the mind out so that we can really take in an experience is so core in working with others. And I have to be able to drop that story of myself, that story of my opinions and my views, that story of the way things should be, my tendencies, my habits, and the things, I hope I can get to All Saints soon because they're having a sale, and maybe I'll be able to afford one of those sweaters that I really like, which actually I was thinking about when I was coming here. Sorry to break the bubble of my vast spirituality. So in my experience, there are four ways that, personally in my experience, that I've had to work with this concept, and then I'll turn it over to you guys, because I have a tendency to babble and chatter on. The first is that the most difficult thing for me in working with others, especially in hospice and hospital situations, is patience. I find it very difficult to sit with myself. And a huge bit of that boils down to the stories I have about all the things I need to do in my life. Why am I here sitting with somebody who's not interacting, or I'm not getting anything accomplished with? There's so much I have to do. And I have to be really willing to drop that really fascinating story of how important the other things are in my life and how many places I have to go and how much I have to accomplish, and I have to be able to put that aside and find the underlying core stress that's masking. It's almost, in my case, my stomach is almost invariably really tight and my shoulders go up around my ears, so I look like some kind of weird thing. And I have to find that underlying stress and I have to breathe into it and relax it. And that process is very much important. I'm sure you've talked about the importance of balancing awareness of the outside and the inside. And that's so core to working with others. If I'm entirely focused on you, the chances are I'm not going to be aware of the underlying vedana, physical stress that's building up. Because a lot of this stuff, these stories, work at us first unconsciously, as we've seen, before we become conscious of it. So it's really important to keep an underlying, what we call mindfulness, awareness of the body, relaxing ourselves, making sure that we're breathing comfortably so that we can truly be present. Being present also means being aware of what's going on inside. It's a balance. It's never entirely external, never entirely internal. It's always a balance. Except when we're meditating, then it's entirely internal. I have to let go of my preferences, which I've talked about. I really have a bunch of tools. One of my favorites is the Vitakka Santana tools, which are the ways of removing stressful thoughts that the Buddha taught. And there's 5 ways to remove obsessions. I love that. And whenever I'm working with addicts, I love to quote that one. And some people just go, you know, they just don't get it. And I really have to open up to working with other tools that are available. And there's so many ways to reach another human being from my own experience instead of quoting endlessly, which I love quoting the Buddha endlessly. But there's other ways. And so I have to be willing to drop my habits. I have to be willing to allow people to have their anger, their frustration, and not try to fix everyone immediately. That's kanti, patience, and equanimity, upekkha. And by doing that, it's really important, again, for me to have an understanding of the way, not only of keeping myself calm, but understanding karma, which is basically some people have been so trapped in a lifetime of thinking a certain way or being, if you've dealt with people who are very sick, some people are so addicted to their careers that even when they're deathly ill, they still have this fantasy of when I get back to work, which doesn't allow them to be present at all. And I've always wanted to say, well, don't you see where you are in life right now? You know, and you're thinking about getting back to your career. And that's because their career has been the thing that they've been feeding off of to get a sense of identity, a sense of security, a sense of purpose. And I have to be willing to allow that person to be stuck there for a long time. And that's patience, and that's equanimity, and that's not being intoxicated by the idea of myself as the healer, or the, which I hate that word, I'm sorry, if you want to be a healer, that's great, I hate that word, but I just view myself as somebody who's trying to act skillfully with other people, and so I have to, but I even have to drop that story. And finally, dropping the distancing of denial. When I've been around people who are very sick or people who are very, very caught in addictions, there's a part of me that wants to say, I'm removed from this. Maybe because I've been a vegetarian all my life, this won't happen to me in exactly this way, or, you know, I'm safe from whatever. And I have to really remember that the core truths of suffering, the loss of the body, the loss of the things that we've attached to, like careers, relationships, our possessions, that everybody will go through, that will happen to me. So that denial that makes me feel safe, maybe this won't happen to me, I have to drop. So again, I have to keep myself calm. I have to be willing to let go of all of my preferences. I have to be willing to open up in myself the knowledge that all this suffering and these experiences will happen to me. There is nothing personal at all about the second arrow of human suffering at all, nor is there anything personal about the first arrow. It all happens to each and every one of us. So I think that's a good place to stop because I'm pretty much out of breath and I've probably given you more than can be chewed off anyway. But I thank you for listening, and I hope that any benefits from this talk goes out to all beings north, south, east, west. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Thank you.